You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 384. First, the new year, baby. Let's get this party started right. And this is John Gentile, and we are back on the Punk News Podcast. Adam White, the New Year's baby. Is he looking prim, proper, fresh, and ready to go? Or is he looking worn and haggard on day three of the year? How's the New Year baby? How's the New Year baby looking?
I mean, we're 3 days in. We've had the threat of fucking social media nuclear war. Steve Bannon is fighting with the Don. And everything's going bananas. And I mean, so far, like, as far as the plot of this stupid movie that we're all in, like
it's unbelievable.
It's pretty good. It's totally unbelievable. Like there hasn't been a lot of fat in the plot. Like, we haven't had a lull. So you know, we're all gonna die. Don't get me wrong. But outside, I mean, we had new Jeff Rosenstock record, like a lot of shit has happened in 3 days. And I don't really know how we're going to keep this up without, I don't know, like an alien invasion or some sort of Cthulhu incident. So yeah, I'm optimistic, John. This is going to be a ride.
Two things. Interesting. You say Cthulhu. I always say Cthulhu or Cthulhu. Interesting.
You're probably more right, but I try not to talk like a Klingon as much as possible.
Nerds in effect here in the Punk News Podcast. Second thing, Adam, maybe it's like the movie Air Force One. The whole movie, you're like, wow, what's going to happen next? Wow, what's going to happen next? Wow, what's going to happen next? And everyone is happy in the end. I love Air Force One, the movie. Adam, as a Canadian, do you appreciate Air Force One, the movie? The movie about a president that kicks terrorist ass on his own airplane and machine guns them and jumps off the plane with a parachute? Or do you find that to be embarrassing and silly?
We don't have airplanes in Canada, so it's not really relevant.
This makes sense. Now,
I mean, if it was like the prime minister on a snowmobile, holy fuck, John, that would be the thing.
Adam, I think you just made a $400 million movie.
No, but Canada is not going to make $400 million on a movie. So in Canadian, it's like a $40 million movie.
Well, listen, are you too good for $40 million? Because I'll take $40 million.
I mean, I'm not. It's just that I want my name in stars, John. I don't want to win a fucking Juno Award. I want an Oscar.
Well, listen,
the Juno Awards are for Tim music. I don't know what the Canadian Movie Awards are called.
To quote Tim Armstrong, was it F the lion's share, I'm a hyena. And if anything underlies the Punk News ethos, it's that indeed. To that end, we are doing a writer's drive at Punk News right now. You can reach me at johng@punknews.org. We're looking for staff reviewers and we are looking for staff news editors. And we have been getting a great response so far. But if you are interested in running for Punk News, now's the time. I'll send you the little information packet. And I got to say, Adam, we've got a lot of people that are interested, people from all over the world, people from all different kinds of backgrounds. And I am excited. I am very excited.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to make myself further redundant to the Punk News machine, which I mean, like I've done pretty good. So with making myself redundant. So if I can continue that, so no one knows what I do at all, that's what I want.
Well, there they go. And we are also here with news editor, reviews writer, interviewer, Tricky Ricky Frankel. Tricky Ricky, do you prefer Air Force One, the story of the president that kicks ass with machine guns and jumps out of planes to save his family? Or do you prefer the lesser known Firewall, the movie about the CEO banker that kills terrorists with a machine gun and jumps out of airplanes to save his family?
You know, I've only seen Air Force One. So I have not seen the other one that you're talking about.
Firewall is really good. It's Harrison Ford again. And the plot is really identical.
It's Harrison Ford again. It's the identical movie.
Yes, it is. It's an identical movie, except for instead of my friend Duncan. Listen, I'm going to spoiler alert. But basically, Firewall is the exact same plot as Air Force One, except for he's a banker instead of the president. And at the very end, like some guy like tries to attack Harrison Ford. So Harrison Ford kills him by grabbing a pickaxe and swinging it around up over his shoulder into the guy's back. And so my friend and I have a saying, pickaxe to the back. So. There you go. It's great. It's a good movie. You can get it on sale for like, well, I'm not on sale. You can get it normally priced for like $3 because no one gives a crap about it. But it's a good movie.
So it sounds like Harrison Ford was the Liam Neeson of the 90s.
I think you mean Liam Neeson is the Harrison Ford of the 2000s. Ricky.
Either way, I find there, you know, it's interchangeable.
And
it's fun.
And until Liam Neeson visits a remote Amish farm. In order to protect an young Amish woman who saw a brutal murder and then ends up seducing her, Liam Neeson will always stand in the shadow of Harrison Ford. Adam, what, you see that movie?
I don't know what we're talking about anymore. I'm trying to figure out where the fuck Firewall came from. 2006, by the way.
Harrison Ford's great, man. I mean, he's kind of a dick, but he's great.
I mean, he keeps crashing his plane, so...
All right, listen. Let's get tonight moving along. We got some good mail. This is from Jason B. Jason B. writes us once in a while. We would like to get his mail. Jason B. says, "Do Bad Religion Week," and that's Jason B.'s suggestion. That's what we should do for the next band week. I don't know if Bad Religion Week is going to happen this year. It might. We've already got a plan for October. The spring, we're still working out, and we'll see what happens with regard to that. But a Bad Religion Week would actually be an excellent week to do at Punk.
Yeah. I'd be actually useful in a Bad Religion Week. Like, I could sit down and write you Bad Religion Esoteria without, you know, having to crib all my notes from Wikipedia or the BR page or wherever else you would go. You guys go to the BR page? Have you been there? It's like, as far as fan communities on in websites go, there's a few that have been around since the early days of Punk News, when you know, we were all living in covered wagons and all that. But there was one that was like this Green Day website that was there right from the start, and the brpage.net, I think, like some Bad Religion website that's been around for fucking ever. So anyways, kudos to them. Yeah, I'd love to write about Bad Religion. That'd be a good idea.
Well, Adam, would you like to helm Bad Religion Week?
Nope. I ain't doing shit.
I could probably help out with that one too. I'm not. I think I don't know if I'm the biggest Bad Religion fan, but I listen to them pretty often, and I think I have some favorites that might be out of the norm for most fans. So I could throw my hat in there too.
The brpage.net was from 1995. There you go.
Wow,
that's fucking old.
Adam, you think it was the first webpage ever?
The first webpage ever was a Bad Religion fan site, yeah.
This is from Austin, and Austin says, "Why feminists hate Taylor Swift? Hey, John, I love the podcast, and I came across the article you might find of interest. I know the debate went on longer than you guys would have ever intended, but I was trying to articulate some views on this when it first came up, as I do feel Taylor Swift is detrimental to the women's movement, and a few things referenced in that debate were not completely accurate. This news story in regards to her feature on Time Magazine is very well addressed and explains the issue in Hope. It helps shed some light on the topic for you as feminists have a very strong argument here as to why Taylor Swift is a detriment to all the progress that has been made in the last year. Hope you enjoy the read and keep up the excellent podcast." And this is from The Daily Beast. And the article is "Taylor Swift is no silence breaker." So you can Google that if you want to read up on that. I did read the article. Austin, thank you for sending it over. I profoundly disagree with the author's underlying concept. The author seems to want Taylor Swift to represent herself as a feminist strictly in the mode that the author represents what a feminist should be. And I think that's completely contradictory. I don't think a feminist is any one thing, and I certainly think Taylor Swift is an excellent representation of feminism, at least in her viewpoint, and I think that author is really just trying to bully Taylor. So I profoundly disagree with it, but thank you for sending it over, and I hope everyone else reads it. I am aware of the irony that we have a podcast talking about feminism and we have no females on the podcast. Well, I am working to rectify that, and hopefully we will have more females on the podcast in the future. Next one, unless you guys have any comment on that, I'll go to the next article.
I don't know what to say about that. I haven't been following that at all.
This is from Lodi Trash, and here's what Lodi Trash has to say. Hey guys, my second time writing in. I just wanted to say that listening to you guys put Dire Straits in their place put a big smile on my face. Other than Sultans of Swing, they blow. Happy New Year from Lodi Trash.
Boo! No.
Listen, I agree.
No way. Money for nothing. Walk of life. Come on, guys.
Dire Straits is so boring. People say, you got to listen to the playing. You got to listen to the playing. I don't care about the playing. I care about the listening. You know what I mean? It's
That's delightful because the more you think about that thing that you just said, it makes no sense at all. But it sounds very profound.
No way. I heard this on the last podcast that I think Tom was on. Nah. I don't know if they were like the first ones that should be like walked into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They are fantastic. I stand by this one.
Dire Straits are the Yvanky Malmsteen of dad rock, and that is a diss all around. Terrible band.
Jokes on you. I don't know what that means.
Adam White, final ruling on Dire Straits.
I kind of like Sultan's Swing, but I don't like Money for Nothing, and I don't know any of the other songs. God. So. In that way, they're sort of like 50%.
Twisting by the Pool?
Don't know. I mean, I might know it if I heard it, but I don't know it by name. So I'm going to say, you know, if this was a school, that would be an F. But I don't know. That's I don't know enough about Dire Straits to like heap judgment on upon them. They're not a band that I've ever thought about. And I don't even recall why we were discussing them. So this is
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
They're a band that in my mind is so beige that they've just bled into the background radiation of the universe, and I don't even remember talking about them.
You know, how about for my birthday today? You just give me this.
Okay,
one.
Dire Straits are the new Bad Religion.
This is from Patty O'Swing from Portland. He says, hey Punk News, several times in the last few years, a band that I love and desperately wanted to see live has toured through Oregon supporting the Super Suckers. I actively dislike their music. I think he means the Super Suckers. So I usually avoid those shows like the plague. However, they came through with the Bomb Pops last month, and I have wanted to see them ever since their interview on Punk News. I guess he means the Bomb Pops, probably. So I went and was treated to possibly the strangest lineup I'd ever seen. The opening band was a local punk band called Burn the Stage. I have seen them before, and they are fantastic. Then the Bomb Pops went up and played their half-hour set. They put on a fantastic show. They have great chemistry with the audience and are a lot of fun. I love their music, and it was great. But then the Bell Rays came up, and while I couldn't say they're a bad band, I have no idea what the genre they're supposed to be. At least for my punk rock pal, they left me searching for a place to fall asleep, like Dire Straits. Having paid my two bits, I decided I would give the Super Suckers a chance to change my mind about their music based on their performance. But it was not to be. Going from the sweet, sticky, thoroughly enjoyable Bomb Pop experience to the Super Suckers was like spreading barbecue sauce on cake, and not in a good way. The dream lineup would be the Interrupters, Bad Cop, Bomb Pops. And thanks to your last episode, I would throw the Sweethearts in there. They're a lot of fun. Thanks as always, guys. Happy 2018. Patty O'Swing. P.S. Dire Straits sucks. And that's from Patty O'Swing.
So hold on. I'm trying to figure out which band he was actually trying to see.
I think he was trying to see the Bomb Pops.
Was he not? Was he, or was he trying to see the Bell Rays?
No. I think he's just mentioning a different band. Like, he doesn't even name that band. But he saw that. Wait. Oh yeah. However, they came through with the Bomb Pops.
Yeah.
So
I think that's
what he's trying to see.
No. Here's what he's saying. He usually wants to see this band, but they toured the Super Suckers, so he doesn't go because he doesn't like the Super Suckers. However, the Super Suckers were coming through with Bomb Pops, and because Bomb Pops were playing, he went and enjoyed them.
You know, I remember posting a story about that tour, and I don't know the Super Suckers or the Bell Rays that well, but it. And I gave him a bit of a listen, both a listen. I thought it was kind of a weird lineup. I mean, I've seen the Bomb Pops plenty of times in the last few years. Glad you enjoyed them though.
I thought we were going to talk about the bell rays, which was moderately interesting to me, but I don't think that's going to happen.
I was going to talk about the bell rays. What were you going to say?
I mean, the bell rays are a band that I always thought had that I don't now looking at their discography. I clearly haven't listened to their last like six records, but back in 90. Let's say like 98, 99, 2000. I'd heard a couple Bell Rays songs, and I thought like they had the coolest sound. I can't remember the name, Lucy. I don't remember her last name. That's the lead singer. Had this
Lisa Kukula.
Lisa. Like I just thought she had like the coolest, like kind of like howling blues voice and everything. But I don't know. I don't know whatever happened to me in that band now. I'm daunted by this discography when I'm looking at it, because clearly whenever I was interested in them was early days, and there's been a lot that's happened. I don't know if I can catch up on this. I have all this homework to do, John. You're like, go listen to every David Bowie record, then go listen to every record in the history of hip hop. And now I got to go listen to all these fucking Bell Rays records. I'm going to get to them by like 2015. I'm at 25, not 15. Time has looped around and I have, but yeah, too much time.
Well, time is not on our side, so we will say reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We love getting your mail. Thank you for reaching out. That's podcast@punknews.org. Let's play a song, and then let's come back and hit him with some news. Who's got some tunes?
I was planning on going second, but I can go.
You go, because I'll go. All right, John, you play a song. I'm ill-prepared.
I'll go.
Ricky's got his shit together.
Okay, so anyway, in 2013, 2014, and even 2015, I was going to a million house shows in Philadelphia, like two or three a weekend. It was awesome. And I was getting hip to all these awesome, awesome new bands. 2016, 2017, and probably 2018, I'm not making it to as many house shows. So I'm not getting hip to as many brand new bands, which it's just kind of sad, because honestly, like, man, like from 2013, I got into Bad Canoes, Crazy in the Brains, Posers, Nightbirds, not necessarily house, but well, they were at the time, Nightbirds, all these awesome, awesome, awesome bands. However, I recently got hip to a new, pretty brand new band. It's a band called the Up Up Ups. It's a Philadelphia band, and they do kind of a combination of punk rock and early rock and roll. So early punk rock and early rock and roll. They've got two releases, an EP and a split 7-inch with the long time cult punk band Abrasive Wheels. This is off that split 7-inch, and it's a really cool track. This is called My Boyfriend's Got a New Girlfriend.
My boyfriend's got another girlfriend. I love him so much, I think I gotta kill him. I'm
and that was the Up Up Ups doing My Boyfriend's Got a New Girlfriend. And I meant to talk about this before we got into the news, but it doesn't make a difference. Boys, the end of year list has posted the number one band of the year at Punk News as determined by math and not by, I guess, editorial insight or editorial decision was the Menzingers, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
It was the Menzingers. I'll just go through the top 10 super quick as I – drum roll, please. This is the top 10 bands at the top 10 releases at Punk News. There we go. Excellent.
That was horrible. That sounded like
a fish. I knew you doing it.
A fish was dying on the ground, gasping for breath.
I didn't hear you doing anything.
Number 10 was a tie for Direct Hit and Pairs and Western Addiction and Blood Clot. Number 9 was Integrity, Howling for the Nightmare Shall Consume. Number 8 was Power Trip. And then from there, we go from the hard and the heavy to the decidedly not hard and heavy. Number 7 was Flatliners, Inviting Light. Number 5 was The National, Sleep Well Beast. Number 5 was Mountain Goats. 4 was Prawn, which I don't think I heard anybody talking about that record, but somehow it's number 4 on the list. Number 3 was Iron Sheik. Number 2 was Propaganda, which everyone thought was going to get number 1, but was soundly blown out of the water by the Menzingers after the party. Other releases that made the top 20 this year at Punk News, Run the Jewels, number 3, which barely missed the top 10 by like just a couple of points, which killed me. Open City and, controversially perhaps, Brand New Science Fiction at number 18. And so that's what it was. Were you guys surprised by this, or did you guys see this coming? Do you think this is representative of the Punk News readership's tastes? And were you surprised at how gentle, soft, and gauzy our top 10 list was this year?
What do you really think, John? I shared the list behind the scenes, and John was the first person to react, and his reaction was oof. I believe, or was it like woof? It was some.
I think it was woof.
Yeah, it was some disapproving subhuman noise. So so here's how this works. Just in case anyone wants to know why we're making fun of our own best of list here. The way Punk News has never sat down as a group and come up with what we editorially think are the best records of the year, because we don't have. We're not a real thing, right? We're just a bunch of people that connect on, you know, Facebook and then post things on a website without anyone, you know, gatekeeping or telling us what we can do or not do or anything like that. So that doesn't lend itself to having a lot of very involved staff meetings. So what happens is whoever we allow to write a Punk News personal best of list in a year, They'll go and they'll list however many records they are, 10, 15, 20. I take all of their picks. I give their number one pick 20 points, their number two 19 points, and so on down the list for however many they have. And then I throw all of that in a spreadsheet together and add it up. And based on the inclusion on everyone's list, that's what generates the actual Punk News top 20 list of the year. So I think that, like, of any of the music publications of note, which I'm going to charitably say we are one of, we put the least amount of effort and import into this than anyone else, at least internally. But I think it has a huge impact not internally, like to people that are actually reading it. And people will read it and go, and like they'll sort of like rightfully go like, oh, like what record did Pitchfork give number one of the year, and what record did Spin give number one of the year, and everything else, right? And those ones, I have to imagine that those lists are actually, you know, hotly debated, and there's, you know, there's like a room where just everyone's just like chain smoking and yelling at each other over a round table, right? And that's how those things are sorted out. That or I don't know, someone parachutes in like a big cartoon bag of money, and that affects some of the listings. Or I don't really know how it works in the real world, because I don't do this for a living. But there is some editorial discussions about these things. We just do blunt math and then spring it on everyone, ourselves included. So these lists are always more informative if you go back and look at the math. And we actually include a link like to the spreadsheet, if you want to be super boring, with our best of list. So you can go there and read it if you want and see, like, you know, who voted for what, basically, and where it falls. Because I think that's very informative. Because if you look at, say, the top three records, so of that math that I just talked about, how many people did reviews this year? Was it 11? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So 12 people did lists this year. So 12 people's picks are what we accumulated to make this. So adding everyone up in the way that I just described, so your number one record gets 20 points, number two, 19, number three, 18, all that. So the Menzingers came out with 99 as their total points. Propagandhi was 90. Iron Sheik was 61. And then after that, you kind of fall off a cliff and everything else gets really close. So Prawn, which is our number four record, is at 40. And then, you know, if I jump down to say like number 10, where Ricky's precious pairs ended up there. We're only at 34. So there's not a huge difference. So if one person who was involved in this list making, situation, if one person went and gave a, say, a 20, put direct hit pairs as their number one, then that would have been the fourth record overall, right? And then by the time you get down to the bottom few records on our list, in which that brand new record falls, those ones have 29 points, but there are how many here? There are at least 20 other LPs that have a score of 20 or more added up. So, yeah. so the spread is like, so it's a little bit of a hockey stick kind of curve here. So you've got like, so like, I think like Iron Sheik, Propagandhi, the Menzingers, there is some staff consensus on those ones that I find relatively meaningful. Everything else is like, you know, if Tom Trauma, you know, when he was sitting down to make his list, walked into the room and stubbed his toe and he was mad and he said, you know what, man, fuck bad cop. They're off my list. Right. On some whim. Well, that knocked them out of the top 20. And there's, you know, anyone's scores matter a huge amount given like the small sample size here. So it's such a weird animal. And I almost don't want to do these anymore. Like, I want to do the personal list, but I almost don't want to do the overall punk news list because I'm thinking that like a statistician would look at this and say, these numbers are bullshit. But like, we're like from a meaningful, like my math is correct, but like they're bullshit from like a meaningfulness standpoint. Right. But you know, What can you do? The people expect it, so we make it. So yeah, that's how these things are made. If anyone's curious, I mean, I would totally encourage you to go read the individual lists because that has way more. It says way more about like the personality and the just the what particular vein of punk rock or rock and roll in general that person is plugged into than this best of list does. So you know, that's my big overlong intro to this thing. But you know, so Menzingers are number one is, I mean, that's kind of boring. Not that I think that the Menzingers are boring. It's a boring pick. Like it's a safe pick. Like it's one of those things where like, if you had to sit down and look at a list of what records were going to come out this year without hearing any of them and you had to like cobble together, oh, the punk news crew will probably like these ones. Well, you know, going Menzingers, Propagandhi, Iron Sheik is probably pretty predictable.
Yeah, I mean, I thought for sure Propagandhi was going to take it this time, but I also had like Menzingers at my number two guess also. Now, when you say the Menzingers is boring, I actually went through past. I was bored, a few days ago, and I went through some of the older best of lists. This is the third time the Menzingers have taken the number one spot. In 2010, Chamberlain Waits got number one. In 2012, On the Impossible Past got number one. Now 2017, After the Party took number one. Rented World got the number two spot in 2014, only to lose to Against Me's Transgender Dysphoria Blues, I believe. And then their first album, A Lesson in the Beast of information technology got number 14 in 2007.
I mean, so I, on the one hand, like, good for them. I mean, the
yeah, for sure.
Right. The, no, the
listen, After the Party's an awesome record. Like, don't. Yeah, it sounds like we're crapping on it, but it's a good.
I'm sorry, I fell asleep. I'm sorry, guys.
Yeah, I mean, like, so I mean, John's not a fan, and John can't give negative points to records. So maybe we should work that into our equation, because if we could, you know, if we could negative point records, that might have affected things more dramatically. But like, and the one thing that really struck me as I was writing this. And I felt like I needed to allude to it in the intro that I wrote to the article, is I'm like, we have basically the way that the math works, like, Brand New is sitting at the bottom of the list. So if you're going to read this article, like, the Brand New record is the first one that you see. There is like a real question about, like, given the like totally despicable things that Jesse, what's his face from Brand New, has been accused of. You know, would another publication that is taking, say, an editorial hand to their list, look at it and go, no, like, we disqualify that guy for being a scumbag? Like, is that happening elsewhere? And we've crossed some taboo line by including that or what? Because that's one of those records that's on the list because two people said they liked it, right? And this is why our sample size is all screwed up. Like, Ronaldo and Max Power both said they liked that Brand New record. Ronaldo a lot. And that right? And that got them on the list, right? So classic. So it's like one person, you know, all of a sudden introduces this whole thing into the equation that wasn't previously going to be part of that conversation. So,
and I can actually give you another example of that. In 2014, I put Morning Glory's
Poets for My Heroes.
No, not Poets for My Heroes.
War Psalms.
War Psalms. I put it number one. I think John put it on his too, and we were the only ones that put it on our list, and it made number 20.
Yeah, so there's it's a weird animal, but people expect us to do them, and I'm okay to produce them for people, but like, I always want to put like 45 asterisks next to it to be like really understand what this is. Like, this is brute force math based on like the easiest possible way that we could add this up, and like, and even the math is making assumptions, because I'm assuming that there is a 1 point difference between your number one and your number two record. And, you know, there is a 20 point difference between your number one and your 20 point record and your number 20 record. But like, maybe that shouldn't be like, maybe we should be giving the number ones, you know, a higher score and your number 20 is a lesser score, so that, you know, everyone, cumulatively, because everyone cumulatively listing one record as their number 20, maybe that doesn't allow it to creep into the top. Like, I don't know. If you work for 538 and you're tired of doing whatever you do over there, come up with a good way to tally up 12 people's best of lists. Where's Harry Enten? We need Harry Enten. John, get him on the line.
I will say what's frustrating for me is that, like, the men's, like, let's assume the men's singing record's a good record.
It is.
Like, okay, like it's not a groundbreaking record. It's not a record that really represents it. Like, Transgender Dysphoria Blues, that's an ideal best record of the year because it's a great record. It rocks, but also it has a statement about the contemporary times and is a daring record for that artist and a new direction for that artist. You know, it really felt like a movement or a statement on culture as a whole, where Menzinger's records, like, here's another Menzinger's record, you know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't say anything.
To a degree, you want that pick to be to say something about the year or to say something like of the time, right? There was one year early on where the pick made no fucking sense, but it eked its way in there based on some math, and I forget what it was. It was like
a System of a Down record.
Like, it was something that, like, I hadn't even heard. I still haven't heard, right? Where it, from all I can understand, is like, whoever was writing for Punk News at the time where we were doing those lists, like, we're tuned into whatever was going on in the radio at the time, and they're like, I kind of like this. And they put it on, and just, you know, by virtue of the math, that's what popped out. And then then you're in this weird situation where you can't make all these like all these talks where we say like, well, it's the math, so don't worry about it, and then at the same time say, oh, but in this case the math gave us an embarrassing one, so we're gonna edit that out. Like, you know, if we're gonna do math, we got to do it, so we just have to suck it up and live with that. But whew, like that.
Well, I think, and I'm curious about this because I don't know, but I think maybe was the sample size a little small this year? I thought there weren't as many lists this year as usual.
No, there was one less than last year, I believe.
Really?
Yeah. And there should have been the same number. I think Jeff Sorley didn't end up writing one. So it would have been the same number as last year doing it.
And actually, we had one more list this year of active actual contributors. We didn't have any legacy contributors this year.
Which So
anyway, right. speaking of the album of the year, Jeff Rosenstock pulled a real doozy on January 1st. He released a surprise album. It was a mega surprise album because no one knew he was recording it. No one knew it was in the chamber. And all of a sudden, it was out January 1st. In true Jeff Rosenstock style, it was free for download, but you could buy the record or the CD if you wanted to buy it. The album is called Post. A lot of surprises in this record. Well, the main surprise is that they recorded it only in December and is out now, which is extremely quick turnaround for any record. But basically, they knew they were going to release it January 1st, and they didn't get to recording it until the first week of December, which is ballsy and cool. They recorded it in the span of a week, and I think if you listen to the record, it sounds that way in the best possible way. That is, this is a record recorded very quickly, and that has helped it out a great deal, much in the vein of, you know, the Stooges' second album or Black Sabbath's first album, Van Halen's first album. Actually, I don't know if that was recorded that way. Anyways, you can tell it was recorded quickly, the Ramones' first album. You can tell it was recorded quickly, and the record benefits because of that. The other big shocker that I guess was understated is that this is on polyvinyl, which I think was a fairly surprising pick for a lot of people. Jeff had two records on Side One Dummy, which those are the records where Jeff kind of went from a org core or generally known in the punk circles band to a much bigger band known in the indie circles and known in music overall. Kind of, I guess you could say the Pitchfork crowd knows about him, the Brooklyn Vegan crowd knows about him, those kinds of people. It was surprising that it was out on Polyvinyl because Polyvinyl is not known as a punk label, but Polyvinyl is known as an indie label. One of the things, I thought Polyvinyl was smaller than Side One Dummy, but it actually looks like Polyvinyl is bigger than Side One Dummy. I might have been incorrect on that assumption. Last thing to point out is that Polyvinyl, this is a fresh for Polyvinyl as well, is they gave the record away for free and they're pressing it, which, I mean, that's pretty punk rock, honestly. Or is it punk? I think it is, but I maybe it's not. Giving your record away for free and then saying if you can buy the record for if you want, similar to what the Melvins do. So did you guys check this record out? Did you like this record? Are you surprised by the Polyvinyl pick? And releasing the first day of the year, will that tend to make him forgotten near the end of the year for best of lists? And does that matter?
You know, I gave this a listen and it's kind of solidified my opinion of Jeff Rosenstock's solo career right now. This, I mean, I know we had some people, I know it was like Sean was freaking out about this and he was digging it. And, but for me, I got to tell you, like, I liked We Cool. Worry didn't really do much for me, even though I don't dislike any of Jeff Rosenstock stuff. It just didn't like move me the way I think it does with a lot of other people. I kind of felt the same way about this one. I realized after listening to this one, I realized like, I think Jeff Rosenstock for me is just an artist that I just love seeing live. Like his live shows are fantastic. So I will happily go see him if he comes through here again. But yeah, and I thought the Side One Dummy thing, him, I guess leaving Side One Dummy was an interesting choice too. I didn't know. I wasn't sure why why the switch. Overall, I mean, this was very cool. I did not know it only took them a week to record this, and to get it out, especially from the pressing plants that fast, is not an easy task. So the overall,
well technically, it won't cool. be out on physical till March.
Oh, okay. Well, still, I mean, that's still fast. I mean, yeah. to do all that, like that's crazy fast. So good on him. Also, But I wanted to mention, like, yeah, I'm still like an Antarctica Vespucci fan. I love that project. So I'm not like a hater. I just, this didn't, what wasn't for me. I will definitely see him if he's coming through here again. So that's kind of my half-hearted opinion, half and half opinion.
So I've not listened to more than half this record because the universe is conspiring against me having the half hour alone over the past few days. So I haven't got there yet, but this is my ideal way that an artist operates in the modern world. And I'd backed off a little bit of my Jeff Rosenstock fandom over the past year. If for no other reason than I'm a contrarian, and I just saw so many people talking about him so much that I was just like, all right, like I don't need to be waving the flag for this. I'm going to go look for something else, right? But he's doing things here the way that I feel that like I would do were I in his position. The fact that he's at this prolific, where he's recording all this stuff all the time, so much that he has more material than the traditional album cycle can accommodate, is something that you can do if you embrace the internet era, as opposed to trying to operate within the traditional album release cycle, right? So if you're doing something where in the old school kind of 90s way, where you're on a label, you know, every year and a half to 2 years, maybe 3 years, you're going to put out a single full length, and then you're going to go tour behind the full length, and then you're going to go away for a few months of vacation, and then you're going to go in the studio, and then you're going to release a full length, and you're going to repeat that 3 or 4 times, and then you're going to break up, right? So Jeff's already, he already sort of broke out of that mold by stopping Bomb the Music Industry and just starting to record as himself. He's always been breaking that mold by the fact that he's just sort of aggressively released everything that he's done for free. And he's got enough clout now that when he's working with other labels like Side One or Polyvinyl in this case, he can get them to play his game where, you know, he can walk in and say to a degree like, all right, look, like it's 2018. People are going to go download this as soon as it's available. So just let them go download it, like a name your price download. If they want to give us money, great. If they just want to hear it, we'd rather they hear it in good quality by getting it from Bandcamp for $0 or for downloading it from quote unquote for $0 than them getting it on some skeezy, you know, torrent site or whatever. Then let them have it. But we know that people who are music collectors, who are fans of this band, are going to end up buying the record. So, you know, if you want to play this game, Polyvinyl, then shit, you can put out the record and help reap that reward with us, right? And Polyvinyl, like, to their credit, were smart enough to get on board and to do that. And apparently Polyvinyl's bent over backwards a little bit to make this happen, because, like, they I guess had to, like, get some staff working over the holidays to, you know, facilitate the sort of like wacky New Year's Day release plan of this, which I think was, again, just something that Jeff sort of sprung on them. And it's that whole aspect of it is great. Like, that's the way that I want to see people doing stuff. And whenever I see an artist that's sort of operating like that, it makes me way more interested in what they're doing than if they're doing the traditional sort of thing, right? Than if they're doing the album every 2 or 3 years, like, that manner of operating doesn't excite me, but this excites me because it lets you just do it. It lets them go and like take whatever that creative shit they have that's going on and just like fucking dump it out there and see what happens. Now, I say all that knowing that I want to qualify that by saying, like, on one hand, Jeff Rosenstock can do this in that he knows that if he goes and releases something for free, he's not going to be, you know, standing in a dark field, pissing in the wind, right? Like, people are going to notice when he's doing these things, and you can you can see that. Like, go to the Bandcamp page for this, and it's, you know, full of little supporter thumbnails, you know, full of gobs and gobs and gobs of comments and stuff like that, right? So he knows that he can go and release something on his own, and everyone's going to stand up and listen to it. So he has that going for him. And he has, I guess, I don't want to say privilege, because it's not really a privilege thing, but like, he has that opportunity given the career that he's built up to this point, right? That he can make that happen. Like, I want to go, every band do like Jeff Rosenstock's doing, but I don't know if that's being disingenuous, because if you're just some garage band from somewhere and no one knows who you are, it is just dumping all your stuff on the internet for free and running ramshackle in your best interest. I don't know, but given Jeff's situation that he can do this, like, I'm glad that he does. And if you are on that Bandcamp page looking on this, go to the bottom of the page under the track listing, under the credits for the record, which you should always read because it's a nerdy, fun thing to read. Go through that. See his little paragraph where he starts talking about the record. Click the little green more link. And he writes, like, he's got like 1,000 words written about this record in there, like detailing all sorts of stuff about the process and who is involved with it and who he's thanking and some of the story behind it and all this shit. And it's super interesting. So you should go read that. So I haven't listened to this. It may, in the second half of this record, totally bomb, to use a word that's not appropriate, but right. But just the way that he's doing it, I think, is just, it's super fucking punk rock, and I like it.
I have listened to this record, and I like Adam White. I was a mega Bomb the Music Industry fan, big fan of Get Warmer, gigantic fan of Scrambles. And then right around Vacation is where I started to have, not problems, but where Bomb and I kind of drifted apart. And that's where, like, I guess Rosenstock became identified by the sadness and depression angle of his music, because for me the attraction of Bomb the Music Industry was crazy, wacky, fun, and interesting artistic contrast. Vacation was the record that stripped all that back, and where they kind of started to focus on the melancholy, I guess, sad Beach Boys angle. And the Rosenstock records up through now have kind of focused on that aspect. However, the most recent ones have rocked. I had a little bit of trouble getting into those records because they were so kind of downcast, despite the energetic rocking music, which is an interesting contrast of itself. This record is the first one that I've really sat down, listened to, and just all the way through, just slammed all the way through. And I got, first of all, this record is another sad record, which, for me, it kind of weighs down a little bit. It's like, I can only take, like Neutral Milk Hotel's album is a great record, but it's 13 or 12 tracks of just depression. And after a while, he's like, all right, I need another emotion aside from sadness. This record is so good in that it is mostly a melancholy record. However, I don't get necessarily get weighed down by the sadness aspect. And that's not to say that all music has to be happy, because, you know, I listen to Rudimentary Peni, the least unhappy band there is. But if you only have one emotion at a certain level, a record gets boring. It's a testament to this record that this record does not get boring. And if you ask me, might be the very best Rosenstock solo album. I like how it's capped by 2 7 or 8 or 9 minute long songs on the front and the back end, which I think is a really cool thing to do. And I think each song has a character, and also really it underscores the gift that Rosenstock has at composition and arrangement, in that these songs are interesting all the way through because they're always changing, they're always growing, they're always shrinking. But they're saying something, and they each have a unique identity, which is really Rosenstock's true skill that almost no other artist, well, not a lot of artists, most artists don't have. I don't want to use too much exaggeration for hyperbole. But I will say, I think there is a certain parallel, maybe not on that level, to David Bowie, in that David Bowie, from about 1971 through about 1980, every year he would put out a new record. And every year he would change himself, not necessarily a radical change, but each record was a significant step. And as we were discussing with Transgender Dysphoria Blues, to a degree, it was a commentary on society. Maybe not that this is what society means, but it shows the growth of the artist, and that growth of the artist can also be reflected back towards growth of the listener. I'm not the same person that I was 5 or 6 years ago. And I think Rosenstock is doing a very interesting job in being Rosenstock, but changing, growing, and also staying contemporary by pumping out a whole lot of records really quickly. When bands pump out a whole bunch of records really quickly, they either become irrelevant because people are like, all right, you know, we put out a record 6 months ago, 12 months ago, we need time to digest it, or they stay on top of the crest and are almost like news reporters, and that here's what's happening now, this is what's happening this year, this is how art is changing. I think Rosenstock is harnessing that in a very excellent way, and I think he's one of the most interesting artists right now. And so I think it's a good record. I don't know if it's going to be in my top 10, but I think it's a very good, interesting record. I think he's being punk rock, and I think it's cool.
I mean, there's something that's a little bit punk rock about it, about just releasing it after you've recorded it and not worrying too much about where in the year it is, right? Like, if you are vying for to be someone's top record of the year, releasing something on January 1st is almost the worst thing you can do outside of releasing it on, like, December 25th. Right? Like, release it at the end of December after everyone's released their things. Well, okay, you've disqualified yourself from, of course, being in that year, but then everyone's going to hum and haw over whether your record is actually a 2018 record or not, and then it's not going to be in. Really, something like in the first few days of January, and you basically have to rely on the fact that whatever you've put out is so strong that it's going to still be, you know, rattling around in people's heads come November, or you just don't give a fuck. And I think that might be more what's going on here. The one thing that I've struggled with the Rosenstock stuff recently, and I just went and I checked. So Scrambles, which I love, John, too. That record came out 2009, right? I don't know when in 2009, but let's say, which I'm saying is, like, I don't know when he wrote it is what I'm trying to get at here. But so there's a song on there called 25, right? That is Jeff reminiscing about, you know, turning 25 and, you know, dealing with the, not reminiscing, Jeff dealing with the weird anxiety of, you know, of hitting that particular milestone age. Right. So,
Adam, I got to pause you for a second. Yeah. How crazy is it that he was only 25 by the time he had made it as far as Scrambles? How crazy is that?
Oh no, it's. I mean, do you think of how much stuff he had with even his other bands that came up before that? It is. I mean, it makes me feel like I've done nothing with my life. But
right, exactly. But,
so okay, here we go. So Scrambles came out in February of 2009. So presumably, the record was actually originally supposed to come out in January. So Jeff Rosenstock turned 25 in 2008. Right. So in 2008. I was 26, right? So I was around the same age as him. But there's this thing that I've noticed with Jeff's music is that it voices this, and increasingly so, and I think this is what you were getting at when you're talking about them being sad, but it voices this, like, millennial, like, this urban millennial anxiety that I have a hard time connecting with. And it has to do, I think, with the fact that, like, I'm, and John, you too, I think, right? Like, we're in that weird in between cohort, right? Because you're same age as me, right?
Yes.
So they actually, like, there was some article where they started calling us Xennials, right? Because we're sort of in between that period where, like, you're definitely a millennial and the time when you're Gen X. And so, like, the stuff in our childhood was analog, and then it was digital when we became teenagers, but we weren't, like, fully growing up in that digital era like people that were millennials, right? And that means, like, a lot of times things that people, like, identify as, like, millennial things, they never really feel like they're speaking to me or about me, but then they'll go, like, oh, millennials are from 1980 until, you know, 2000, whatever. And I'm always like, 1980, really? Like, that, I don't feel like that's my generation. But I think that however he's lived his life, for Jeff, it is more of his generation. And a lot of the things that he is specifically on these more, like, on these more emotional, say, tracks that he's been writing on his last few records, a lot of like the anxieties and things like that that he has been voicing, I think hit home huge for like a certain slice of the younger audience. And by younger, I mean like people in their late 20s, say, right? And it's never connected with me in the same way. And I don't know if it's just because like I've been married for almost 10 years and I have two kids and I live in a house. Like him singing songs, you know, complaining about the rent in the apartment in New York City and all that stuff is so far removed from what my day-to-day life is that I have a hard time connecting with it. But like, I've been grappling with that because like there's people I know that are just die hard Jeff Rosenstock fans, not in a like, oh man, I love the music way, but in like a, this guy speaks to me way. Like I hear people talk about Jeff Rosenstock in the same way they talk about, say, like Craig Finn from the Hold Steady or fucking Joe Strummer sometimes, where they are just, they're in tune with, you know, with the vibe that he's on and the things that he's talking about and the things that he's voicing. And like, I'm not there most of the time, and it makes it a little bit more difficult for me to engage with his stuff lately. And it was less of a problem when he was just being crazy, like on Scrambles and just, you know, just playing bonkers music. So I'm curious to see how much that's a factor when I really get into this record, because it's I've definitely noticed that. That aspect to it, where like he is like fucking like he has hit the vein of a certain, I think, well shared group of emotions and problems and common struggles, but they're not mine. And yeah, I'm never quite sure how to deal with that.
Continuing the theme of sadness, we'll do this real quickly and then we'll play a tune and come back with some funny stuff. Pam the Functress of The Coup has passed away. This is very sad. The Coup is, if you ask me, one of probably the five greatest hip hop groups of all time. The early members are Boots Riley, E-Rock, and Pam the Functress. Pam passed away after getting an organs transplant. She was in critical condition for about a month, and then unfortunately she passed away. She also served as a DJ for a couple of other groups early on. She did a little bit of DJing for Tupac, and at the end of Prince's career, she DJed for Prince. The Coup is one of the most unique groups in hip-hop. They're hip-hop, but Boots Riley himself is an avowed communist and anti-capitalist, and the music is basically, I think, they're the only hip-hop group that expresses what they express, and not only do they express it that way, they do it with an extreme level of comedy and enthusiasm, which you don't really see too much, those things going together. I've seen The Coup live a couple of times. I saw them with Pam once. Pam was an incredible DJ. She was an old school DJ that she mixed with two records live on stage, and that she was willing to cutting and scratching. And also she had a real, DJs don't always have a personality. She had a huge personality on stage and really was, in later day, I guess the three main members of The Coup were Boots Riley, Silk E, which is kind of, she's a singer. You can tell she's influenced by Tina Turner and Pam the Funkstress. And between the three of them, it was an amazing triad of things, like live performances on stage. Unfortunately, just prior to her death, she and Boots had a little bit of a misunderstanding. Basically, Boots is working on a film called Sorry to Bother You, which I'm very excited about. Pam came to the set, but Boots didn't know she came to the set. And so the security turned her away and she took it personally, and Boots didn't even know about it. And so their last interaction was not so great, which is sad. And Boots did a very touching letter about it on Facebook, which you can read. But Pam the Functress, one of the most unique and greatest DJs in all of hip hop. And it's quite sad to see her go. I guess Ricky and Adam, you guys, I don't know if you guys have anything to say about Pam or The Coup or anything.
You know, I've only known like their hits, so I don't think there's a ton for me to say. And also, I was more of a Street Sweeper Social Club fan, but this definitely is sad. And also, she wasn't that old either.
Not only about 45 or 50, yeah, something like that. So, All right, we'll play a song, Ricky. We'll come back with some laughs.
All right, cool. So a friend of mine showed me this band recently. I've been kind of slowly going through their catalog. And they're called the Down and Outs. They're out of Liverpool, England. And I started with one of their first albums called Boys from the Black Stuff. And it's cool stuff. It's cool. It's kind of pop punky. I think I definitely hear some Stiff Little Fingers in there. And they've been around for a while. Like, I think this record came out in 2004. That's one of the songs, the record I'm going to play a song from came out that year. So, give these guys a shot. They're fun. But I still need to keep going through. But I really like this song. This song is actually the title track called Boys from the Black Stuff from the album by the Down and Outs. Here it is.
You had a wife and four kids. Two at school and two on a dole.
I get, but unfortunately the two on the dole don't count.
Nobody on the dole counts, friend.
From 79 to 1990, the North was stopped on it. They thought that we would lose our voice, thought that we'd disappear. Come flowers from the top. The guilt of slavery. Shipyards are haunted by the ghosts of industry. You don't understand what we went for. We're forever, forever. Dogs are angry now.
And that was a Down and Outs doing Boys from the Black Stuff. All right, boys, this one is probably my favorite story of the week. We've been following the Mean Jeans jingle campaign for some time amazing. Now. It really is amazing. Mean Jeans have been recording jingles for products. The joke being the products haven't paid Mean Jeans to write the jingles. They did jingles for Coors. They did a jingle for Mountain Dew. Mountain Dew gave them some free Mountain Dew. I don't think Coors gave them anything. Last week, the Mean Jeans did a jingle for Totino's Pizza, or maybe that was 2 weeks ago. And then just a couple days ago on Twitter, Mean Gene essentially said, we didn't hear anything from Totino's, so we're going to remix our jingle to their competitor, DiGiorno. So they just took the exact same song, edited out the word Totino and put in the word DiGiorno. And then on Twitter, this is the funniest part, Twitter... On Twitter, they're like, we haven't heard from Totino's. Maybe DiGiorno will help us out, right? And then on Twitter, DiGiorno was like, then on Twitter, Pete Zeroli, who handles Totino's social media, he was like, what? We love you guys and we love the song. However, Mean Jeans decided to play hardball and they said, thanks, guys, but which song will we be performing on our upcoming tour? Give me Totino's or give me DiGiorno. You decide. Please send frozen pizza and dry ice. Then DiGiorno got in the fray. DiGiorno said, they ignored you for 2 weeks and loved the remix. Easy decision here. And so it looks like that Mean Jeans, here's what I think is awesome about this. Usually when it comes to endorsement, a product comes to a company, a band or an artist or whatever, or an actor, and says, okay, we will give you money to endorse us. And the artist reluctantly accepts the money and endorses that product. Here, Mean Jeans is essentially extorting Totino's into giving them free pizza because they say, listen, if you don't let us endorse you, we'll endorse your competitor, which will hurt your market share, which I think is Adam or Ricky, is that the ultimate sellout or the ultimate anti-capitalist attack? I'm loving this.
This is why Twitter was invented. I mean, this band has succeeded in getting national, maybe international brands to fight over one of their jingles that they probably took a half hour to write and record in public. And so that in itself is amazing. I hope they play these live. I'm seeing them later this month with the Shrine, so I will report back, but I am loving this. Like I said before, they need to put all these jingles together at some point for some special release, and I hope they keep doing this because not only is it hilarious, but the subsequent Twitter war made it that much better.
Adam, are you going to poo-poo this?
You can't poo-poo this. No way. Don't be like the trolls in the comments of this story. This was awesome.
I can't believe Adam's going to poo-poo this. I can't believe this.
Oh, boy. All right.
Here we go.
No, I mean, Mean Jeans can do whatever they want. There's going to be some point where if they keep doing this, where I think it may stop being funny. But what I would more want to criticize is I fucking hate that we live in a world where two different frozen pizza companies maintain Twitter accounts to talk to people and cutesy ones.
Well, like, have you seen the Wendy's one?
They're trying to be the Wendy's one, I guess. Like, I'm looking at the DiGiorno pizza account and it's full of like snark and emojis and things like that. And there's 116,000 people that follow the fucking frozen pizza company, which posts snipey little things. And like 700 people, like here's a tweet from December 21st where it is a sad face emoji and then a pie, and then a graph, like a chart emoji, which that's it in the tweet. And 800 people have liked this, and like 262 people have retweeted this. And I mean, even if you're going to buy into the, you know, the snarky social media account run by the company is funny because they're being snarky and daring and all that, and not, you know, not worried about the corporate image or whatever, you know, if you're going to buy into the, oh, hey, the Wendy's account is funny thing, basically. Well, then when all these other fucking companies start doing that, and then you're all in there lapping up their dumb marketing messages and passing them around on the internet, what the fuck? Like, that's, you're out there advertising for them. Jesus Christ. So I'm not criticizing Mean Jeans really at all. I am worried that their shtick is gonna run thin, and if for no other reason than, like, let's say they go and they do like three more jingles in the next 3 weeks about other products, and then we post the same article about them every week, and then we have the same discussion about them every week, like at some point it's going to be like, okay, that's this band shtick. All right. This story is great. I mean, I like that they're trying to extort endorsements out of these companies like that. That's fantastic. Don't get me wrong.
That's hilarious.
It's hilarious. I can't get over that these accounts exist for them even to talk to.
Oh, I agree.
Mean Jeans is a post-consumerist commentary on that exact thing, Adam, and they're exploiting it to their benefit. This is hilarious. Who invited Urkel to the party?
I think it's funny also, but I agree with Adam. At some point, this shtick is going to get old. Not now, obviously, because this is hilarious and I love it. But at some point, this will run out. I think this will run out of steam. For reference, real quick, the official McDonald's Twitter account has 3.5 million followers.
Why?
They keep upping the ante, which is making the first was just a soda, then it was like a beer one. Now they're extorting money from pizza. This is hilarious, people. And oh my god,
yeah, I agree.
How many pizzas do you think DiGiorno is going to sell because Mean Jeans is extorting money from them?
30,
like none. 30, you know what I mean? So I think it's hilarious. And oh man, I'm quitting Punk News. No one's got a sense of humor around here.
I'm with Speaking you on people, this.
You're fired, Rick.
I mean, like, how much did DiGiorno pay the Punk News Corporation for the free advertising that we gave them?
How many pizzas do you think DiGiorno is going to sell because we posted about
that? I don't know. You've seen our commenters. They're all disgusting. They're probably just gorging themselves on disgusting frozen pizza.
Well, honestly, Adam, if me posting this helps clog the arteries of certain commenters, I think it's a positive maneuver. Listen, speaking of positive maneuvers, this is a cool little thing. We'll just do this briefly. The Shrine have released a 7-inch. On the A side, it's The Shrine and Keith Moore singing a song called Never More Than Now. This was also a bonus track on their CD that came out last year. As Tom Trauma so helpfully pointed out in the comments section, instead of letting me know directly, I don't get that at all. Anyways, the point being is that this is a new track. It's really cool. Fun factoid about this track: the guitar player from The Shrine played the song through an amp. What is the significance of that amp? He got that amp from Chuck Dukowski. Who did Chuck Dukowski get that amp from, Adam White?
Did he get it from Keith Morris?
Well, he got it from Greg Ginn, who got it from Keith Morris. So the guitar amp on this 7-inch is literally the same physical item that was used to record the vocals to Nervous Breakdown, which is a cool, fun little factoid. The other factoid is the reason the guitar player from The Shrine has that amp is because Chuck Dukowski was going to sell it on Craigslist, and he asked for help from the guy from The Shrine, and the guy from The Shrine just said, I'll buy it, which I find it kind of insane that Chuck Dukowski would just sell a historic amp for, like, Craigslist prices, you know, just for, like, normal amp prices, when this is which is considered, I guess, a punk rock artifact, if you will. And my question is it worth extra money because it was what Greg Ginn and Keith Morris used to sing through? Because I mean, Glenn Danzig's Misfits gloves just went for like some insane amount of money, like $40,000 or something like that. Is that unique to the Misfits? And the Black Flag amp is really just worth an amp? Or could there be more money squeezed out of this? Because that's what we care about here on Punk News, squeezing money out of things. This track is cool.
Oh, I think the track is awesome. And I mean, this kind of works with that show I'm going to see. Shrine's headlining that Mean Jeans show. So I hope Keith will make an appearance for this song. I don't know if I pre-ordered this when I found it, because I think the song was awesome. The video was cool. Keith is still kicking ass. Like, I mean, when I saw him off twice this year, this last year, and even in this is awesome. And I'm into this for sure.
I haven't heard this because Ricky told me that it existed 2 minutes before the show started. So,
last two stories, we'll rip through these pretty quickly. Run the Jewels have released a new video off their album RTJ3. The video is for Call Ticketron. RTJ3 came out earlier this year, and perhaps an ode to Jeff Rosenstock. They also gave the album away for free. They've given away all three Run the Jewels albums away for free. Call Ticketron, I think, is one of the strongest tracks on the album. I think we're getting a divisive response here on the Punk News Podcast. I think Run the Jewels is one of the most interesting, if not the most interesting, modern hip hop group. I think Call Ticketron is a fantastic song. And I particularly like how in the video, like their videos, their albums, and their shows and their promotional material all ties together with a certain theme, which I think is really, really cool. I think this video is really neat, and then it ties together a lot of 80s tropes with a lot of modern tropes. And I think this track is awesome. Killer Mike and LP are awesome. This track is killer. Check it out.
Still don't like hip hop.
Yeah. What can I say?
All right, John, let's do this final story. Let's get it over with.
This is, I don't know why these guys aren't like this either. This is amazing.
I'm going to go for a nap.
You didn't like this? You didn't like this, Adam?
It was fine. It's not something that I would have sought out, and I am sort of bewildered by your continuing interest in this artist.
Alice Cooper?
Yeah.
Dude, Alice Cooper's a legend.
I mean,
Alice Cooper like invented punk rock.
All right, sure. Whatever you want, John.
I really am stymied that the punk rockers don't understand the importance and embrace Alice. I mean, all the real punk rockers love Alice Cooper, John Lydon, Jello Biafra, the Melvins, the Stooges. They are all huge Alice Cooper fans.
I get the foundational influence of Alice Cooper. It's just that, like, I listen to this track and I'm like, if you didn't tell me that this was like Alice Cooper in particular and they didn't have any of that history attached to it, I listen to this track and I go, this sounds like sort of like a generic 60-ish rock song to me.
I agree and disagree profoundly at once.
You can't agree and disagree profoundly.
I am medium, listen, both.
You're aggressively neutral.
No,
I'm extremely modern
Alice Cooper records are hit or miss. Some are really good, some have really good songs, some have really bad songs. The newest one is called Paranormal. It's okay. This is the last track off Paranormal. It's called The Sound of A. When I heard this actually through the video, I'm listening to this, I'm like, holy crap, this song is amazing. I'm like, why doesn't he always write songs like this? Like this, I'm like, this sounds like early Alice Cooper group stuff from the late 60s. As I read into it, it turns out this track is an unrecorded song from 1967, which explains why it's so out of character.
It's super 60s-ish, right? Like, I like that comes through totally on it. And it's completely competently done. But it's just that if I walked into a... John, if I walked into an Old Navy because I needed to buy some jeans and this song happened to be on the Muzak at the time, I would not be offended by it, but I would not like yank out my phone and go like, who the fuck is this? This is blowing my mind. That's all I'm saying.
I don't know how people can be. I don't know how people can say, oh, the Menzinger is so great. And then they're like, this is like, oh, this is Old Navy music. This is like the creepiest song. This is a creepy, weird, late 60s-ish song. And it's amazing. And Alice Cooper's importance with regard to punk rock cannot be overstated. Like Alice Cooper, like he invented the stage show. He invented, you know, he invented the bad guy in rock and roll. Well, maybe the Rolling Stones did, but he or the Rolling Stones invented the concept of the bad guy in rock and roll. This track is amazing. And I don't know. I'm not trying to be cute. I honestly don't know why punks and punk readers and even Adam don't love Alice Cooper. Like Adam, did you ever listen to the Killer album?
No. See, that's on my list of all this homework that you've given me.
Well, I'm going to assign that to you. And listen, Alice Cooper's a man, and this track is cool. Ricky, you have any insight here or what?
John, I love Alice Cooper, and you are totally right about him being in.
Thank you.
And being, no. There's quite the twist here. And you're right. I remember even watching interviews with Jello talking about how influential he is. His stuff's great. I saw him live, God, it must have been 2013 or so, and it was awesome. Loved it. This song wasn't good, though. This music video...
This song is awesome!
This song was not that great. This song, the music video is kind of on the corny side. Yeah, this didn't do much for me, but I agree overall with your premise that Alice Cooper is very important to punk rock. This song isn't, though.
This track is great. We'll let the listeners decide. Check it out at Punk.
The commenter seems to
we didn't even say the name. We didn't even know the name of this. We didn't even say the name of the song. We just started arguing about Alice Cooper. It's Alice Cooper, The Sound of A. You can check it out at punknews.org. Ricky play a song and then we'll wrap this baby
up. I already played
up.
A song.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Adam, did you play a song? Adam played
a
song.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. Ding, 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 ding. What am I doing? All right, so there is a band from Ottawa called Average Times that plays kind of cool Ramones Corey stuff, and they had a record that came out in, I want to say like September with, it feels like zero fanfare, and I don't get how sometimes just records just appear and the band doesn't even seem to say all that much about them, given the fact that they can do so for free. So, but hey, well, I don't know. Here we go. I'm going to play PR for Average Times. So Average Times are cool. I'm going to play a song from this. This is called Out of This World. It's from the new Average Times record, which is called Seconds, which it combined with their name. If you Googled Average Times Seconds, all of those words sound like they're about stopwatches and things, and it will make it completely impossible for you to Google this. So so in any case, here you go. So anyway, so yeah, so this is a song called Out of This World by Average Times out of Ottawa.
And that was Average Times, and that wrapped up this podcast. We had some conflict this episode, but it was healthy conflict, I'd say. Healthy disagreement, robust debate and conversation. Ricky, any last words to the listeners, and any final explanations as to why Alice Cooper is great and everyone should go out and buy School's Out, Killer, Billion Dollar Baby, Welcome to My Nightmare, and Love to Death album?
You know, I learned that being radically neutral on something is a thing. So that's where I'm at. I'm going to enjoy the rest of my birthday. And yeah.
Adam, closing words.
Stop writing us about Taylor Swift, people.
Yeah, that too. Stop. Yeah. Yeah.
Keep writing about Taylor Swift.
We don't remember what Taylor Swift. The controversy was.
Also, we don't care. She's not important.
I care.
Alice Cooper is more important than Taylor
Swift. No, don't get Ricky all riled up. This isn't a matter of our opinion. We don't remember because we're old.
This has been a Velour Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or, you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at Greg at VelourUndergroundStudios.com.